My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and of course, you're listening to The French Connection. A very important interview today with two gentlemen that I have the highest regard for. Their research has been one of the reasons why I've been fighting so hard, because after I saw their work, I realized it was possible to put out a story that would be not only understood by the public, but it would make a difference. And the most important thing I learned from their video that they put out, this DVD they have out, is that many times in the past we have been successful at rebuffing the attempts by the international bankers to take control of our nation. In fact, we've gone back and forth with this battle at least a half dozen times in our history, and actually won back our right to the money system that we should have had from our Constitution. The two people I'm talking of, one of them is named Bill Still, and the other is Patrick Carmack. They both are responsible for the video, The Money Masters. This is one of the most important, I think, videos ever done. Not just recently, but ever. Why? Because for the first time, we've pulled the curtain back on a system that is placing the human family under the yoke of a debt. And that debt system is taking away options that people might otherwise have had as a result of that system, and enriching people who are already so incredibly rich that if you were to calculate their wealth, it would be obscene in the extreme. However, so I'm going to bring my guests on, and we're going to get right into it. Bill and Patrick, are you with me?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we're here.
It's wonderful to have you on the show, guys. I really have to thank you. And Bill, I'm going to actually go to you first, because you're the face on this video. And I want to ask you where and how to get your video right from the beginning, so you can give out that information, your website, and details like that, so we can maybe direct people to the purchase of that video.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. It's at www.themoneymasters.com. That's T-H-E and then Money Masters, all one word. And I just wanted to correct one thing, and that's when you said right at the top of the show, the problem is that the system that is in place tends to consolidate money to an unfair or unjust degree. I think maybe Pat would agree with that.
Yes, and you're right. It's a system now. It's no longer based on just individuals. And the way the system is set up, it inevitably concentrates wealth, and now at an exponential rate, in fewer and fewer hands. And so we have a situation now where literally a couple of hundred people control virtually all of the wealth of the world. That's, you know, a significant amount. And Americans, for instance, in the last 100 years have gone from 90% owning their own farms, or at the turn of the century, 1900, to 90% not even owning their own home, much less farm, but being mortgaged to a bank. So we've had a complete reversal in the economic status of most Americans.
So it's almost like a nation full of sharecroppers.
That's exactly right, or tenant farmers. And the model for it was taken, in fact, from England, where the independent yeoman farmers were reduced to the status of tenant farmers, and that's now happened in the United States.
Well, so let's start off with when was this project started, and how did you get to decide on how to do this and why you did it, maybe from both of you?
Okay, well, if I could just add one more comment, and that is the result is that the system that's in place is the greatest exacerbant of global poverty. It's not the only cause of global poverty, but it's certainly the greatest exacerbating cause of global poverty.
Well, it's resource restriction, gentlemen, and what happens is if you don't have the means, you're certainly not going to have access. And that access that you might have to better health or better water systems or better education or better family planning ideas or all that is going to be down the drain if you don't have resources. And the resources are never left in the hands of the people who need them most.
Well, and money is the means to resources, and money is what's controlled. That's the whole aim of this entire present world financial system, is to restrict money and to allocate its control to, a relative handful of people.
And well, so you started this at what year was this project undertaken?
96, wasn't it, Bill?
So it was maybe September of 96.
Mm-hmm. And were there any predecessors that you actually admired in advance of doing this project? People that you maybe had looked into this in a similar way, and you found some inspiration from them?
Yeah. There was a guy in Cleveland by the name of Ted Thorin who wrote a little book called, I believe it was the Money Book, wasn't it, Pat? Who seemed to be the most rife on. Other than that, Ed Griffin did good work in the area, but of course Ed comes to the exact wrong conclusion that gold is the answer, when in fact gold is and always has been the problem. In other words, if you try to force your monetary system through the narrow neck of a precious commodity, then you have just the same thing. It increases the rich guy's club's ability to control the quantity of money in any system.
Well, can I tell you, gentlemen, this is just my opinion, I don't see intelligent people coming to the wrong conclusions by accident.
Perhaps.
That's just my little caveat.
I think Pat wants to say something, though.
Well, yeah. I'd just like to add, I think it's fair. First off, I agree with Bill. Returning to a gold system does not contain the answers to this problem.
It doesn't.
However, Ed Griffin did, he did terrific research, and we certainly are beholden to him. But besides him, Milton Friedman did wonderful work, and he did it for decades. Of course, he's recently deceased. And
was Mr. Friedman always on board with the facts, or did he sometimes straddle a fence?
Well, Dr. Friedman, I guess the point where we would depart with, from his positions would be that he was very much, a laissez-faire type of economist, so he wanted to get the government out of, its involvement in the economic system. And we think the government does, in fact, have a proper role in the system. In fact, it's precisely because it's been so privatized that, the entire banking system with minor exceptions is controlled by private individuals, that it's no longer working for the public good.
Mm-hmm.
And we would depart there.
In fact, yeah. Abraham Lincoln has a direct quote on this topic, whom really came up with the correct system, and that is issuing money directly from Congress, the closest federally elected representatives of the people. And this is what he said on this topic. The privilege of creating and issuing money is not only the supreme prerogative of government, but it is the government's greatest creative opportunity.
That's right. And it makes perfect sense, but by the same token, what we've come to discover is that the politicians that are supposed to be working on our behalf, more often than not, are not working on our behalf. And if you go all the way back to the beginnings of the United States, when Alexander Hamilton was doing his deeds behind the scenes and working with Morris and the rest of them to set up these first banks, you're not always getting what you think you're getting when you elect somebody, are you?
No. In fact, these people that have sought this power, it goes back generations now. And they're obviously clever. They have succeeded to a remarkable degree in amassing tremendous wealth. And, once you can pay your utility bills and so on, it amounts to a vehicle to power. So they have tremendous political power. and that's handed on to the next generation and so on. That's been going on about 300 years now, basically since the founding of the Bank of England. There were antecedent banks, but none that had reached a national scale like that.
Well, you do. You guys do some historical referencing of money changers going all the way back to the temple in Jerusalem when Jesus cast them out, and you actually make parallels to the boom bust cycle of Rome, and then the ultimate bust of Rome when the money supply was reduced. Were these same forces involved as far as your research could find, or did they take their lessons from these people?
Well, it's really the latter. Once some clever means of manipulation of money were developed, then later generations refined that and expanded it. So whereas, for instance, in the Middle Ages you had manipulation of money supplied by the goldsmith in one community, by the time of the Bank of England, this was done in the entire nation. So instead of simply having an unusually wealthy man who really didn't earn it, but rather acquired wealth by manipulation in one city, you had an entire country enthralled to the handful of bankers, in the case of England, who started the Bank of England.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a refinement, and they learned from each other, and it's still going on like that.
Well, I look at the Merchant of Venice that was written by Shakespeare, and he talks at length about the usury and about how unscrupulous businessmen are moving about the society that he was discussing, and how they were exporting this idea. Now, if you take a look at actual history and not Shakespeare, you can see the Medici fortune moving into France and beginning to take a very important role in the royal family of France. And this all had to do with money changers. It all had to do with goldsmiths. And it seems to me that this same group has exported itself in different morphing examples, but has found its way around Europe and now into America over the centuries. And it doesn't seem to be a big departure from the formula that was used back in Di Medici's day.
Well, there are differences, actually, and the refinements are fairly remarkable. And but, at root, it is the same. And, usury, of course, has, in the Middle Ages, it was forbidden by the church in the Christian West. And, over time, with the expansion of mercantile activity, it was recognized by moralists in the Middle Ages that money had a value and lost use and risk and so on. And so there were some charges that could be added
mm-hmm.
for interest per se. And without getting too complex about it, the fact is the manipulations of money became so involved that the previous moral safeguards against it were obsolete. And the West really hasn't recovered from that yet, and so what's going on with the manipulation now is not safeguarded by sufficient moral teachings, from anybody at the moment, because it's so complex.
Well, and you're right. I mean, I'm not going to go into this right now with you guys, but I know that the invention of hedge funds and derivatives and carry trades, when you're talking about hundredths of a point of difference, is making small fortunes for people, and betting on something to lose, and then using short selling to do it, and all of this stuff has developed in the modern era, and almost has absolutely nothing to do with you buying something at the store, but it does affect that purchase at the store greatly.
If I could direct the conversation a little bit here. What's vitally important is that certain political leaders throughout history for the past 900 years or so have risen to the point where they understood what was going on and became outraged at thinking that government should be serving its citizens rather than enslaving them.
Mm-hmm.
And these certain political figures have moved against the goldsmiths back before the Bank of England, and against privately owned central banks throughout the course of American history, and they have made a difference. They have paid a price. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. Andrew Jackson, there was an attempted assassination on him.
Wasn't Garfield killed also, right?
Well, we didn't get into Garfield because I didn't think it was strong enough to prove. However, that may be the case. Certainly back in the time of King Henry in 1100 AD in England, he saw what the goldsmiths were doing, manipulating the economy by making their gold coins either scarce or plenty, and thereby manipulating the political situation of the nation. So he issued money from the public treasury, which were merely sticks of wood. These are tally sticks.
Yep.
And you have to understand the concept of tally sticks and how important they were, that they were just simple sticks of wood, and yet that broke the back of the money changers, the goldsmiths, for over 700 years. And it was on the back of tally sticks, this totally fiat currency. There's nothing wrong with a fiat currency. You don't need a currency backed by gold. These simple sticks of wood were the financial vehicle upon which the British Empire was built, the greatest empire in the history of the world, the empire which the sun never set upon.
And wasn't it their demise when they switched over to the other system? I mean, that was the beginning of the end for them.
Yes, that's absolutely true. My point is that we cannot set up some type of concept in people's minds that even though they're vastly powerful, they have huge wealth, that they are impregnable. They are not.
We can
defeat them once again. All we need to do is just be determined that we're going to get the truth out, and we can defeat them or at least give them a significant setback once again.
Well, Pat and Bill, if I didn't think we had a chance at changing the way things are moving in the world, I wouldn't be bothering with this. I don't do this for pay. I do this because I care about the future, and I understand what's going on behind all of this this stuff. And I gotta ask you. You know, we take a look at the influence in America, more specific than Europe, and you take a look at what our forefathers, what the people who formed America said about this. I mean, and this especially after Jefferson spent time in France, knowing full well that the France's central bank was already under a lot of influence of these people, borrowing against credit and the rest of it. He came back to America with some very fixed ideas about not going down this road to a central bank owned by private individuals, didn't he?
Yes, and you know, Jefferson was very aware of it. Madison was aware of it. Monroe, Jackson, Van Buren. Washington was not clear on it. He relied on Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
and Hamilton was actually connected to the bankers, and so that's how we, you know, how the central banks that were attempted at that time were initiated was under the influence of several people associated with Alexander Hamilton. But you're right, Jefferson very much opposed all this. I think one key point that the listeners might need to understand is that this is not essentially about whether or not a central bank in a nation is a good idea or a bad idea. It's actually objectively considered a good idea. The question is who controls it and for whose benefit does it operate? And what we have in this nation, the United States, since the passage of the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, is that the private banks create approximately 98% of all the money in the United States, not the Federal Reserve System. It simply provides the base, the 2% that's used as the base to, you know, through a multiplier effect for the private banks to create 98% of the money out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important. A private central bank is, you know, obviously a bad idea, but if they only created a small amount of money, it makes relatively little difference.
Well, could you explain for the listeners what a debt-based monetary system is? Because I understand that if we actually were to pay off the debt of America, there'd be no economy based on the way the system works.
There'd be no money. Go ahead.
There'd be no money because it would actually do itself in, wouldn't it?
Well, that's right. And so it all goes back to the, you know, the fundamental law of how money's made in a given country. And in our country, it's the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. That was the great coup, and that set up our present system. It had antecedents going back to Lincoln in the National Banking Act of 1863 and 1864, which he was forced to sign under the pressure of needing money to finance the war he was in the middle of, the Civil War. But it didn't reach culmination or completion until 1913. And the way it works in this country is the Federal Reserve money that it issues, either in the form of paper or in the form of Federal Reserve deposits, can be multiplied by banks 10 times, and there's exceptions to that that make, instead of 90% of the money therefore being made by private banks, it's actually 98% due to the various exceptions and so on. And what happens typically now, if you take an example, say if the Fed, if they wanted to expand the money supply, say this week, the Fed would go out and create electronically, just on a keyboard, say $1 million in money in a federal deposit account, and the open market committee would authorize the purchase of $1 million in, say, bonds from the open market, at the bond market. That money then is paid to the people who sold those bonds. Well, that's federal deposit, Federal Reserve deposit money. The banks can multiply that. And the way it works very briefly is what happens is, say that $1 million is put in one fellow's account. He sells all the bonds that they purchased.
Yeah.
All right. Then that bank can loan 90% of that. So, $900,000 they loan. And they keep 10% on reserve, because that's the reserve requirement presently, is 10%. All right. Then that money, however, he doesn't put in his mattress. He deposits it, either buys something from someone or puts it back in the bank. The bank can then loan out on it again. In that case, $810,000. And this process is repeated. Again, it doesn't go in a mattress. It's put in another bank. So the banking system as a whole gets this money deposited over and over again. And it takes about 65 times before they've exhausted its ability to be loaned over again, because each time taking out 10%. And so the result is an expansion of the money supply of approximately $10 million.
And is that not considered the velocity of money as it goes through the economy, how long it takes to exhaust itself into all the different places it can be loaned out?
No, velocity is a different concept. It's simply how quickly the process takes place.
Right, how quickly.
Yeah, but the process itself is not the velocity of money.
But does the fact that we've got this system out there, and these people can inflate or deflate at will.
Right.
What kind of effect does that have on the day-to-day life of you and I?
Well, if you're like most Americans, you're heavily in debt now, and you do not own your own home. Now, why is that? Well, when you went to the bank when you wanted to buy a home, you don't have the authority, the legal authority to create money. You can't simply, go to a press and create money and hand it to them. But the bank can do exactly that. So you went to the bank and you requested them to make money for you in the form of a mortgage loan. And so let's say they loaned you $100,000. Where'd that come from? Well, most people assume it's other people's money deposited with the bank. That's not true. The money, as I said, 98% of it is created by that private bank down the street from you when you walked in the door and filled out their forms and met the necessary requirements, whatever they chose to make them to be. Then they created that money on their keyboard, and you have to pay it back over 30 years. And, at 10%, you're going to pay for your home 2.7 times. What they do to earn that? Nothing except keep track of it all. They didn't go out and earn it. Most of it is not other people's money. It was created on the spot. That's the system we have. It's a banking cartel. If you're a banker, then you're one of a privileged few that legally have this right, stemming from the Federal Reserve Act, to create money. And just think of what anyone could do if they can create money, and that's what they do. They use it.
Now, does it pay its way up to the Fed? How does the Fed get its cut? How do they take their cut?
Well, the Fed is owned by private banks, okay? And their principal function actually is a smokescreen. The Fed makes only a relatively small amount of money. It's still billions, and the people involved in it, make billions. And the banks, every member of the Federal Reserve system, every bank gets a certain amount of stock in the Federal Reserve Bank in their territory. There's 12 Federal Reserve territories.
Yeah.
And banks. And the private banks own the stock in that. Not you or I. We can't buy it. You have to be a bank. So anyone who says it's not privately owned is simply misinformed. And if they want to read who owns it, go to the Federal Reserve Act. It's public. Go to any library and read it. And they can read who owns it and who owns the stock. And those banks appoint two-thirds of the directors of those banks. So the notion the public has, control of it is simply false. And, you know, the system as a whole has a board of governors appointed for 14-year terms, which is really, you know, an incredibly long time. So even a president can't remove more than half of them until the virtually the last day of their term. So, you know, it's an independent body within the government, and they determine the amount of money to be created. But the private banks get the benefit of it, 98% of the benefit. They're the ones that actually create it. Only the small base does the Fed make, but the Fed sets how much is to be made. And, of course, again, the Fed is controlled by the private banks. So the whole system's for the benefit of the stockholders of private banks. And the last point I'd mention on this is simply, who benefits? Is it your little grocery, you know, little bank next to the grocery store? No, it's not. It's a handful of major banks that get roughly 80% of all the money in this country they create. We're talking about Bank of America, Chase Manhattan, and so on. It's roughly four banks that do all this. The little banks participate, and the bankers get, they make millions on it, but they don't make billions. The big banks make the billions, and that's where the power is. And that's what they use to buy media and political control.
Now, you do talk about the fortune that was built up around the Bank of England's the usurping of the Bank of England's control by a certain family at one point. It was during the early 1800s when the war between England and France was ongoing, and you talk about one of the elements within the Rothschild fortune communicating across Europe making insider trading decisions, if you want to be honest about it. Now, this particular family has very little written about it. If you go on the internet or you try to discover what kind of fortune is in the hands of these people, you can virtually find nothing on them. And here's the interesting thing, and Eric brought this up with me earlier. When you look at the Forbes list of the richest people in the world, they're not even in the top 50.
Hardly any of the world's richest people are on the Forbes list. I mean, all that does is measure wealth that is in their name. And the very wealthiest people on the planet have very little property in their name. And so it really is a very misleading.
So how does that work? Because what we'd really like to do is find out the group, not necessarily the individuals, because I'm sure there are some names of individuals in Europe and elsewhere that we could name, but rather the groups that are actually exerting this influence.
They're just bankers. It's not the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderbergers. It's just bankers.
Well, I mean, we've got in France where I live. I'm calling from France when we speak here, and in the country I live in here, we have a bank called the Banque Nationale de Paris. It is solely owned by the Rothschild family, and its ties to Lazard Frères are incredible. I mean, and then you've got other banks. You've got Société Générale, that's controlled by Warburg. And my point being that it is traceable because the Banque Nationale de Paris is traceable. He also owns, you know, almost every large corporation here is almost entirely owned by him, Veolia, Vivendi, and so forth. It is trackable, and they do have money, but they have it in these trust arrangements.
Yeah, they use nominee ownership, you know, and, you know, there's all kinds of vehicles to conceal control. And obviously, just think, you know, it's clear that if you had that kind of control behind the scenes, you would not want it known. I mean, if the major banks and behind them the bankers who own their stock put their name on everything they own, everyone would faint. I mean, you go in any major city and you'd see nothing but a handful of names on virtually every building and every major enterprise. So that's clearly something they don't want known, and so they use every vehicle possible to conceal it. And one of them is, and this began with J.P. Morgan back in the 20s, I believe, 1920.
Mm-hmm.
He started buying the 20 major newspapers in the United States, and since then they've used it to buy the mass media. You know, almost all of the mass media is owned by the major banks. That's just simply a fact, and they use it to make sure that this whole system's not exposed, and because
right.
People would, you know, be horrified by it, and they'd realize, why is it that the harder we work, and now we have our wives working, you know, the harder Americans work and the more hours they work, they're still poorer every year. And
yep.
That's with the technological increases, because it's all being sucked up by these banks. And
still,
the third world, yeah.
I contend that you're going down the wrong trail if you start bringing up Rothschilds and the Warburgs and the Rockefellers, because, well, number one, people's eyes just glaze over, and number two, it doesn't matter who the individuals are. It matters what they're doing, and if you just, we need to get off this focus of individuals.
Well, but at the same time, it is a part of your presentation that it takes up significant amounts of your effort.
Yeah, and that's true, and that was necessary because it's the video of the Money Masters is a history.
Yeah,
covers 300 years, and this all began obviously with individuals and some very clever individuals, and they were terrifically important in its development. As you go over time, quite obviously, it doesn't relate to individuals because it's now 300 years old. And so all of the people that originally began it are long dead, and so are their grandsons even. So, you know, it really is, there's really no group you could think of that, if they were, simply to disappear, would solve anything. It really wouldn't happen.
We have found something that's a little different in our research, and it might not shock you, or might, but there is a group of people from that have a particular political bent. We call it Zionism, but if you take a look at Hollywood, you take a look at the newspapers, you take a look at CBS, NBC, CNN. And even over here in France, every single major network is all in the hands of a single group, and they are identifiable. I don't want to go into names because I don't think that's going to be beneficial. But when you take a look at this and pull the curtain back, it is a group that is predominant, and they are a very tiny portion of the population, but an extraordinary portion of the control.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. We do not need to get into that. That is not productive whatsoever.
Okay. I think Bill's point is that, again, these are like the great-great-great-grandchildren of the founders of most of this system. And so obviously individuals are involved in it. There can't be any question about that because it's a human enterprise. But it's individuals. Now we're talking, six generations. So you can't pick any one person. You could pick a person, no doubt, and say that person ultimately has the most power. But that person will die someday and will be replaced by someone else. The system itself is thoroughly corrupt. It's the system that needs to be changed. It's a legally imposed system, and the law needs to be changed. Pursuant to the Federal Reserve Act, our Congress approved this mess. Admittedly, they were deceived, or many of them. Perhaps many of them were lazy and didn't do their duty, on our behalf. But it is the legal system we have, and the response to it is it needs to be reformed. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the, so to understand the history of it and the individuals involved is important, but it's the system itself that's, I think Pope John.
So your point is that regardless of the fact that there is a concentration, it still could be, the playing field could be leveled just by a systemic revisit or a systemic change.
Sure, absolutely.
You can't change the individuals. You don't need to change the individuals. It's the system is tremendously capable of penetration by us and change.
It's not going to happen like, where someone introduces a bill and all of a sudden Congress just, gets enlightened and passes a reform. It's going to happen by little bits and pieces. And it does. People respond to one area of it they understand that's thoroughly corrupt, but they don't see the whole picture. So the educational process, like your program here, is very helpful. People need to understand it is a corrupt system. It's been around now for hundreds of years. It's tremendously powerful. The people that are in it are often sucked into it. They grow up in it, actually. And it needs to be attacked in little ways that each of us can do, such as this show.
But what I found out, though, gentlemen, is that when we are successful at battling back against the control and we send these people packing, because there is no follow-up on keeping the control in our hands, we end up giving it back to them. We've changed hands several times, and that's quite clearly expressed in your presentation. And I'm wondering, short of finding out how these people are doing it at the top or who's making some decisions, would we be able to actually retain the change if we ever get it?
It's just like any other form of freedom. It's not free. You have to educate your children and your grandchildren as to what are the basic principles that keep us free. And this is the most important principle.
Well, I also am aware that they're willing, that the group behind all this stuff is willing to murder human beings wholesale. If you take a look at what they fostered in the Civil War, we lost millions of Americans dying, killing each other, in some cases brother against brother. But that didn't stop there. We've had other European wars and World War I, II, and purges at their hands in Russia. We're talking about, let's say, conservatively, hundreds of millions of people have been murdered at their demand.
Well, I mean, you're talking about geopolitics, and when the world reached such a state that, you know, decisions could be made, for instance, in London, that would affect, you know, the political status in China and result in a war, then you're talking about world power, and there's always going to be people who seek it, and there's always going to be people who resist having all power concentrated in very few hands. Because, you know, as Lord Acton said, and we're all aware of it, that all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we want to avoid that, and it's clear that that's a very real danger and that it's happening. And so how do we resist it as individuals? And, you know, and that's the part of it is definitely education. You know, from the gospel, the truth sets you free. If once one understands how this whole system works, then one can, on an individual level, avoid many of the pitfalls of it and help others do so, and ultimately perhaps help their nation do so.
Well, now, it's expressing itself in our modern world in similar ways as it always has, and we have wars being fought, and debt being run up, and inflation being foisted upon the least able to handle it, and what's happening today in the geopolitical realm that is in keeping with the whole, you know, banking structure that has always been in place?
Well, you're seeing the effects of it more and more because, you know, when wealth gets concentrated, it reaches an exponential rate and due to compound interest. And so, you know, whereas you could have gone to, say, South America or Africa 30 years ago and observed economic conditions, then if you go now, they're dramatically worse. And again, this is despite all the increases in technology and so on. And it's because the money is being sucked out of those countries in interest. And this is due to this world financial, you know, structure.
Mm.
And it's been consolidated now, not above the national level, but to the international level with the Bank of International Settlements, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Yeah.
And so now what you have is the entire world, with very few exceptions, is having monies being created by these entities, loans to these countries, and then they have to pay interest. It's often loaned to corrupt dictators and so on who waste the money, and then the nation's enthralled forever to these international banks. The whole world's being enthralled to them, just like a city block could be by, you know, one rich person if everyone else is poor. And, so,
did you find, gentlemen, that there, I mean, for me to consider a decision that would implode a country and force starvation on it seems to be beyond anything I would be able to do, because I'm not capable of making a decision that would do that. It seems like you'd have to be a sociopath to not empathize or sympathize with a population suffering and actually make a decision that would cause that. What is it about the group of bankers and their decision-making process that divorces them from a human perspective on all of this stuff? What did you find when you looked into this?
I think it's just the average effect, the typical effect of extreme amounts of money. It just hardens your heart.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about people who live very differently from the average person. I mean, that, you know, they're no longer concerned with the day-to-day survival. You know, they've got tremendous power and influence. And there's no doubt, if you read their literature, some of them, whether they believe the rationalizations or not, who knows, but they rationalize it that ultimately they're aiming for a world, you know, freed of war and so on. It's all utopian, obviously, and it's not going to happen. But, in fact, it's causing more wars and it's causing more poverty. But at least in their rationalizations, they say, you know, that if we just go on this course a bit further, you know, eventually we can impose this, you know, world peace under our control, a control by these handful of bankers. In order to do that, they have to deceive everyone, but that's the, at least the ostensible rationalization. Whether they really sit down and, you know, when they're all alone and realize the horrors they're inflicting on whole nations, who knows?
I see the geopolitics of this. I mean, we see the, you know, there is a very powerful system out there that tries to put each one of us, every thinking person into a pen. I'm a capitalist, I'm a Republican, I'm a communist, I'm a socialist. And basically, if you take a look behind each and every one of these systems, you'll find the bankers. And are they playing everybody into the middle here on this stuff? Because it seems like when the czar needed to be overthrown, they chose to do it with socialism. But that they still retain control over the natural resources, as you see what happened in 89 when they descended like vultures on Russia and took everything that was there.
You know, Orwell had some great insight into this, of course, in his novel 1984 and also Animal Farm. Clearly when, you know, if you were to have the kind of wealth and control that these bankers have, these major merchant bankers have, then you'd probably also be smart enough to figure out that opposition's going to arise. And so what they do is they co-opt the opposition. You know, they fund individuals in the what appears to be the opposing camp who will, you know, propose things that appear to be against the banks, but really it doesn't go to the heart of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It preserves their power. And that's happened over and over again. So, yeah, you have to be extremely careful in looking at the opposition to see who's financing it. Are their principles really sound, or do they really do little more than change the leadership, like in Animal Farm?
Which is exactly what I think it goes on here in conservative America with this continued drumbeat of the need for a return to a gold-backed economy. It won't solve anything.
Hmm.
There's two real red herrings. One of them's, you know, this thing gold, you know, go back to the gold standard. Well, how much do you own? I mean, very few people own very much gold. Guess who owns most of it?
No surprise if you told me.
Yeah, well, obviously the major banks do. So that obviously doesn't solve anything. And by the way, we had it before, and it didn't prevent getting us into this situation.
That's right.
Another one is that if we just make the Federal Reserve publicly owned instead of privately owned, that really wouldn't change anything because, again, they only issue about 2% of our money. It's the rest of it. Who creates the rest of the wealth that's critically important? The Commonwealth, you know, the res publica, should create all money. That is to say, the state. And it's not a communist notion at all. It's to take it out of the hands of these handful of private individuals so that the government itself, when it creates money and spends it, it can reduce our taxes, it can pay off the national debt, and so on, rather than having a handful of these individuals doing everything behind the scenes.
But isn't the eradication of the debt-based system the best way to go? I mean, why should we have all of our financial system based upon debt?
This is another red herring that Pat was talking about that I always hear out on the conservative lecture circuit, and that is, oh, we have to eliminate this nasty old fiat currency. You know, these people just totally don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, the debt-based system can be distinguished, though, from a fiat currency. I mean, you know, a fiat currency simply means it's not backed by any commodity, whether it's gold or silver or anything else. And there's nothing, we do not need a gold-backed currency because there's many monetary systems right now that are fiat, almost all are, in fact. But whether it's debt-based or not is a different issue. It does not need to be debt-based.
No. Nope.
That's simply a mechanism for the control we've been talking about.
And isn't that boom and bust built into debt-based?
Well,
when you've got
really
a debt-based system, aren't you automatically kind of setting yourself up to have either an inflationary cycle or a deflationary cycle built in?
You are, because ultimately people can only borrow so much. There's a finite limit to it.
That's right.
So when that point is reached, then you're going to have a recession or a depression. I mean, and that's why we have this continual cycle.
Well, isn't that like a Ponzi scheme?
Yes, it is. It's very similar.
Hmm.
And
well,
it's not necessary.
One other thing that I wanted to point out as far as another thing you'll hear people say giving the power over creating the quantity or limiting the quantity of a nation's money to the elected officials and say, oh, those rascals in Congress, they'll just spend too much. Well, maybe they will, but at least they're electable. At least you can make it a political issue, a campaign issue. Where we can't now. We have zero control.
Well, and if they waste the money, it's wasted on public enterprise. I mean, you know, of some kind, whether it's a bridge or a highway or, you know, whatever it is they're spending it on. You know, it's not simply put in the bank account of one individual who then uses it to buy up TV stations and radios and newspapers to manipulate, you know, public opinion and so forth and hide this. So obviously it's far better if it benefit even in a poor way. The people as a whole rather than a handful of individuals.
Well, you know, I in my last conversation with James Gibbs Stewart over here in Britain, the Broomsgrove Group, I think his name, the name of the group he started, he talks about the exact same changes that you just discussed where we don't necessarily have to have debt-based, and certainly this fractional reserve system needs to be reexamined, but he's very strong about not going back to gold. He says gold as a basis for your wealth is it's just ripe for destruction, ripe for manipulation.
Well, and my contention is that's exactly why I got into this in the first place, because an old gentleman by the name of Ed Durrell called me up and said there's no gold left in Fort Knox, and it took me 15 years to figure out what in the heck, what relationship that could possibly have to everything, to anything. And I believe that they were preparing for, they were trying to consolidate the world gold out of the hands of the U.S. federal government as it was stored in Fort Knox, because at the end of World War II, 70% of world gold was stored there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, there's none, and I believe that they were preparing as one of their plans that if we were to return to a gold-backed currency, well, guess who would own all the gold?
Yeah, and the central banks have been selling it off for, you know, years now.
Yeah, what's his name over here in Britain? What's his name? He's supposed to be the next chancellor, not next prime minister, but nobody likes him. He actually sold gold at the lowest price it could be sold at in the last several years. And, I mean, the French are still selling theirs. What's going on with that?
Well, and who's buying it is the question. And this goes to a prediction, I guess you'd say. People are debating whether or not this means that the end game on all this is the world will, in fact, go back to the gold standard, and guess who will own it all? You know, for the golden rule, it's he who has the gold makes the rules. And so,
you think that's possible?
That's one scenario, and it's certainly possible.
Mm.
You know, another one is that things will continue as they are, because that's working remarkably well for the bankers as well.
Right.
And, you know, as they're consolidating wealth more and more rapidly, then, you know, they're accomplishing their objectives in that manner. So either way could go, and it's even possible they don't even know which way yet. You know, they're going to wait and play their cards as they see geopolitics, you know, play out over time.
Well, you know, and one of the things I've seen,
have their main plan and their backup plan already working. Their main plan is working well, and their backup plan is ready to roll out if needed.
Sure.
You know, I've seen a lot of people, especially in the alternative press, which is a growing force in the world, try to muddy up these facts. Now, I've always known that's about power, money, and control, and they want to muddy it up with religion. They call the people the German death cult, or they call them the Luciferian controllers, or they call them the Jesuit, you know, the Jesuits did it, or,
well,
I mean, if you listen to this stuff, you would be shocked, but I gotta tell you something. There are millions of people, drinking up this stuff. And I try to move people away from that to a rational standpoint and say, this is nonsense. This is about money, power, and control. Look at history. Look at what's going on in, around you. You'll find out that that this stuff is a way to move people into another kind of pen.
Well, you know, if you want a real simple way to cut through all that is just, you know, it's like, look, put all that aside because, you know, to whatever extent there might be some truth here and there in it, the simple fact is you can go read the Federal Reserve Act, and it's all set forth right there. And if you have difficulty with it, talk to someone that's, you know, understands, you know, the language of it or whatever. But this isn't, you know, the fundamental elements of this entire system are public. You can go down to any library and read them. So whether or not whatever agencies are used that, you know, that are clandestine and conspiratorial and all, they're fundamentally secondary. You know, the primary element is right there for the public to see.
Are they financing the deception, or are there the people interested in keeping this system in place, financing it, or is it just developing out of its own inertia, in your view? Because you've seen the deceptions they've been willing to use over the generations in America in order to get their way. Are these deceptions actually sit back and plan them out?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, a good number of them have been exposed over time, and a number of them are discussed in the video and in other books like Ed Griffin's and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know many of them are very conscious, they're very deliberate, and in the intents to deceive the public, so there's no question that happens. And that shouldn't surprise anyone. We're talking about vast quantities of wealth and power and so on.
But
so,
why is it specifically religion that they hook into? It's because that's something that people share in common regardless of, I mean, some kind of spiritual following is something that they seem to latch onto quickly. And I notice that when I'm in the alternative press, I've got people telling me that there's a Christian reason for it, and some people say it's, of course, a Jewish reason for it, and then other people say it's Muslims, and of course you see this being played out on our airwaves as well. And I'm trying to move people away from that to look at it more in a more simplistic manner and say, look, this is an easier story to understand.
Yeah, I think it is an easier story to understand. However, there's no dimension of life from which one can utterly remove religious notions. I mean, they're critically important. For instance, you're probably opposed to this system because it violates your sense of justice. Now, you don't feel people ought to be starving, you know, by being cheated out of what little wages and, you know.
That's right.
So that's a religious motivation, and that's in my view anyway, a proper one. And so you really can't divorce it altogether because at some point you're going to have to appeal to people's fundamental beliefs about, you know, this universe we're in and what it's all about.
I agree with that. And you know, to be a nihilist and try to go forward in this world, it seems like the people in charge are. They don't have any beliefs except for a belief in power and more power. I can't imagine. Do you think there's a goal that they have in mind? Is there some place they ultimately are heading with this system, in your view?
Absolutely. They wish to eliminate the concept of nationalism because nationalism is the only thing that stands in their way politically at this point. It's sad to say but true, but it's the independent power of a nation state to go to war with another nation that is the only thing that keeps the world free. Just as the American system of government was set up with the separation of powers notion, whereby different nodules of power were set up so that they could fight against each other if need be.
Mm-hmm.
The separation of powers concept on the international level is the independent nation-state being able to go to war with each other. And once that is sufficiently bridged, once their new world order is consolidated under one central world dictatorship, even though they claim it's going to be a peaceful dictatorship, it will definitely be a dictatorship. And so that's what they're after. They're after the elimination of the concept of nationalism.
I'd depart slightly from that. I mean, I think that's largely true on the political order, but again, going back to this religious perspective, we've been focused on what's essentially a negative, circumstance in the world, you know, the main the main vehicle for the concentration of political power and wealth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, positive things happen all the time. For instance, this show, you know, which will enlighten people and hopefully help them.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's all kinds of people doing good all the time and without, you know, monetary gain or, you know, just out of, you know, charity, just
That's
kindness.
Right. Yeah.
And if you add all those up, they exceed the evil. So the world continues on. You know, there's nothing new under the sun, and we're going to see this get worse. We're going to see it get better. You know, where it ends, we know what their goals are. It's clear it's the concentration of wealth. Fundamentally, these men are materialist. It's quite evident. You know, if they're not religiously motivated. They want to control the material world. That's what they think is important in life. You know, if you had $10 billion, I doubt you'd be trying to make another $3 billion. You'd probably be quite content. Most people would. But that's not how they are, you know, because it translates into power. They want more and more power. That's a very human failing. And, but for religious people, that's not the primary motive. And they war against this in their own little ways without payment. And, you know, there's billions of us.
Well, there are some deceptions out there right now, such as the global warming one. And another one that I'm seeing here is the fact that we're running out of water. I just went through the wettest season I've ever seen in my life here in France. And then right on my TV tonight, the French broadcaster is telling me that I'm going to have to meter my well so we don't use up all the water, and my well is overflowing into the yard.
Let's try to avoid some of those other side political topics.
I'm wondering about the way that this power is being used around the world as a tool. Because basically the ECB, the European Central Bank, is not largely different than the Fed, is it?
No. It's the same system. You won't find, really, except in a few nations, you won't find a different system. It's been imposed pretty much around the world. And if a nation wants to get very much involved in world trade, it's going to have to join the system. You know, Sweden, back in the 30s, I believe it was, basically got out of the system and kept their money supply under control, and the government issued it, and the screws were put to Sweden. They had to abandon all that within a few years. So, you know, you just can't. That's the nature of the game now. Very few nations have been able to break free of it.
Are there any that you can identify?
Well, I think there's a well-known case in Malaysia that
mm-hmm.
you know, was well advised. As to how this system was manipulated and how it would be used to take over the Malaysian economy.
Yep.
And the former prime minister there resisted that and passed some laws that made it very difficult for that to happen. In fact, he prevented it. So it can be done, and I'm not sure it can be done in a major nation without, you know, terrific consequences like war, but it can be done here and there.
Well, you know, the people that did that in Malaysia that helped him put that together are friends of mine. And, in fact, you might be happy to know they've been on this program.
Yeah, well, they certainly did a wonderful job for Malaysia, and he was well advised.
Well, I'm taking a look now, too, at consolidation of resources. And I don't see that they see resource consolidation any different than money. For example, the mining industry and of course the natural resources coming out of Africa and South America. How is it that they use that as a part of the plan to consolidate this control over? Because money and commodities today are almost synonymous with power, aren't they?
Well, sure, they both contribute. I mean, money, you know, the unique thing about money is it can be used to buy anything.
That's right.
You know, a commodity like tin, for instance, if you get a monopoly on tin, you can set the price for it up to a certain, you know, it does have a price where no one will buy it anymore. They'll switch to an alternative, but you can make tremendous money off of, you know, monopoly of tin. And there are some things like uranium, which are terrifically important in terms of military, you know, technology. So, but in general, the commodities are not as important as money itself, because the object in gaining a monopoly is simply to use them to get more money.
Well, but now, so I was going to have a segue to this, Pat, about the use of that money that the contraction and expansion of the supply to get people to go bankrupt, because we're heading into a bankruptcy cycle in America right now. And isn't it the hard assets they're after rather than the money being a problem? They're after the hard assets, aren't they?
I think they're, I think really you have to focus on their after power. I mean, you know, again, once you pay your utility bills and have all you can eat and, you know, have 10 mansions or whatever, it becomes an issue. If you still want more, if you're a real materialist, then you want power. And so that's what they're after. So it's not a question of the hard assets or it's what's most effectively leveraged for power. That's why they went out and bought newspapers and the television media and so on, mass media, because that's really a highly leveraged and vehicle for power. They didn't go out and buy, you know, at that time, wheat fields and such, because those are, you know, those aren't very useful for power except in a very long range. So, you know, they'll try to pick the what logic would dictate would be the most you know, highly effective means of gaining more power. So whether that be water, you know, it has to be things that they can make scarce because they have to be able to control it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, are there any publications or any still in the mainstream news sources that you've come across that seem, in your view, not to have been compromised yet? Because, well, the French Connection is not big enough to be considered mainstream in any way, but, I mean, we get 10,000 to 15,000 people a day, and over time, 50 or 60,000 people will download us on a given story. But are there any places that people could start turning to get the kind of the factual stuff and kind of had an adjunct to this information?
By far, the most powerful media in that regard is talk radio in the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously another one's the Internet, and people can do research. And this, you know, this, we all began ignorant of it, each one of us, because, you know, the mass media and the schools don't tell us anything about this. They deceive all of us, so we
That's
all
right.
have to gradually discover it. So there's plenty of books on it, actually, and you just have to weed through the chaff and find the wheat in there, the grain, and find out just little by little what seems true and what doesn't seem true. And it's not that difficult, really, because a lot of good folks have written good stuff about this.
Have you gentlemen been approached or asked to stop doing this at any time?
Surprisingly, no. I've done over 1,000 radio and TV interviews on this and related topics, and I've gotten a couple threats on air, but nothing's ever materialized. I was really surprised, kind of disappointed.
I've had a few threats and some people poking around my windows at 3 a.m. But I'm still here. And Eric and I, you know, we still do this stuff. And some people say, why aren't you? Why haven't they got you yet? And I wonder that sometimes myself.
Well, I think the more influence someone has, you know, the more danger there is of that kind of thing. You know, I mean, basically, folks who are aware of what's going on are somewhat marginalized. But if someone, you know, if someone's radio show, for instance, you know, really became hugely popular, I mean, I think there you'd begin to see some real serious interference, you know, of various kinds.
Well, we've had that. We are persona non grata in just about every corner of the alternative press these days, because what we've discovered is that they've got quite a budget earmarked for deception out there, and this subject actually doesn't get treated very often on the radio, and you know, I've been pounding away at my audience to watch this video and buy it from you folks. Because it is a remarkable documentary on just how all this came to be, and once you marry this with some of the other information we've discussed, is why we get into some of these false flag operations and how they all work. It's not hard to understand how this deception has been put together. I mean,
right?
It becomes quite simple, actually.
Yeah, that's right. And the deception, really, a good part of it is to make it seem very, very complex. And truthfully, it's all just part of this, you know, power grab we've been talking about. And once you begin to see the outlines of it, then the pieces start falling into place and you begin to understand. And it makes you less subject, makes all of us less subject to manipulation and demagoguery. And when they raise the next savior, you know, politically of the situation, we can recognize him for the fraud he is. And
If I could give the website again, Pat, before...
Please do that, yeah.
That's www.themoneymasters.com. And also, I've been fighting just this last week a little fight on Wikipedia.org to have the Bill Still entry stay up. And so far, it's still up there, and that has a lot about the Money Masters and monetary reform as well.
Well, and I'm going to put a plug in for putting me back up on Wikipedia. They've kicked me off 3 times. Actually, I'm wearing that as a badge of honor these days. I want to tell you guys, you know, that I would like to do an additional file when my responses from my listeners, which I get 50, 60, sometimes 70 emails a day when we put up a good file. There will be a lot of questions that will be asked of me to ask of you. And if you have the time sometime in the upcoming weeks or months to sit through another one of these, I would appreciate it if you'd make yourselves available. Is that possible?
Sure. Oh, sure. And, you know, I just want to tell you and your audience that, you know, it's a great treat to finally have my good friend and colleague Pat Carmack do one of these shows with me. As you can see, it wouldn't have been nearly as good a show without him.
Well, Pat and Bill, you know, I gotta tell you guys, I appreciate it. I mean, I have a good background in finance myself, and that's, I think it helps when somebody who knows a lot about it already is able to ask the questions, you know, because some of the questions I asked, and I hope are questions people listening had in their minds.
Yes, it does help because, you know, it's an arcane language and jargon, and it cuts through a lot of it for folks. So, yeah, it's really good you have that.
Well, I want to thank you both again for coming on to the French Connection. And, again, ladies and gentlemen, the people are Bill Still and Patrick Carmack, and they are both responsible for having worked on the Money Masters video. And I urge each and every one of you to see that. I urge you to buy it from them. Go to their website. It's going to be posted with this file on the website. And I urge you also to take a look at the system that we've discussed tonight and start maybe getting some questions you might have for Bill and Patrick for our next discussion. But moreover, I think take a look at their website and start understanding ways that you can divorce yourself from participating in this usury system, because it's not serving you as a citizen, it's not serving you as an individual, and certainly not bringing any happiness to your life. And if there are ways we can kind of take actions to move away from this system, it's just going to be all for the good. So that's the French Connections show tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and I'd like to thank you again, and I'm telling you to be well, and until the next time, bye-bye now.